Okay, Brian, prediction time. What do you think we'll see at CES 2026?
Come on now, this is easy. Self-driving pizza delivery drones.
Okay, I absolutely love that. I was going to say AI-powered fashion shows, but either way, we'll be there co-hosting and you should be too.
CES is where the future gets made in real time, where visionaries and bold thinkers reveal breakthroughs that shape our world.
Every moment sparks innovation and action.
Because when the world is watching,
when the stakes are high,
when the opportunities are real,
innovators show up.
Join us by registering at ces.tech.
See you there.
This is CES Tech Talk. I'm James Kotecki, exploring the trends shaping the world's most powerful tech event, CES 2026 in Las Vegas, January 6th through 9th. Today, we celebrate two sections of CES that will highlight some of the show's boldest ideas. One is the CES Foundry at the Fontainebleau, the all-new nexus for AI, quantum, and blockchain innovation. The other is C-Space at ARIA, the CES Center for Marketing, Media, and Branding. One company planning a powerful presence in both places is Vector, a consulting firm that helps grow and monetize audiences. At CES, Vector will highlight AI breakthroughs and the changing role of marketing in what it calls the audience age. Here now with the preview is Joe Olson, co-founder, partner, and CEO of Vector. Joe, welcome to CES Tech Talk.
Thanks, James. It's good to be here.
Okay, so Vector calls itself the consultancy for the audience age. That seems like a very deliberately chosen tagline. So what does that mean?
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, the information was really the edge in business. And then in the 2000s, and at least for the last 20 years, up until COVID, technology was really the edge. And you saw pretty much everything in our business community wrapped around those two pillars. Post-pandemic digital behavior, creator platform economics, generative AI, agentic AI on the horizon now. I think the audience age is where we're in now, where the real value of a company is about the audiences it can grow, serve, and monetize, not necessarily the products or services it sells. And what we do at Vector is to try to help these organizations shift from that product service transactional thinking to more of an audience-centered ecosystem thinking in the way that they go to market. So blending all those new cultural anchors, partnership design, go-to-market reinvention, and all those types of things together to help them grow. So we're not just helping clients reach people, we're helping them build long-term relationships that create business value in new ways.
So does that imply, if I think of myself as an audience-centered company, that what I should really be doing is just figuring out whatever my audience wants and figuring out whatever I have the capacity to give them, and then wherever that overlap is, that's what I should be doing as a business?
I mean, I think the opportunity that's open now is just the ability to provide audiences anything that they find valuable if you're the right person to provide it. So if you look at a lot of organizations today, they're really structured around kind of what we call Plan A, which is take the traditional way they've gone to market for forever and wrap everybody and all the resources around that. So they're not considering Plan Bs, Cs, and Ds, which could be new marketplaces or new P&L additions in their own right. But also the innovation spread when you launch Plan Bs, Cs, and Ds that you gain that can either be pushed back into Plan A or will remain standalone, like I said, as a new line of business or a new way of going to market. It creates real money. That's a huge opportunity that's available to every business now for a lot of reasons coming out of what we're calling the audience age.
What's an example of a business figuring out this Plan B, C, D, et cetera, and then looping that back into maybe more of a core understanding of what it does?
Yeah. So I think like the earliest examples of this would be collabs, because it's the thing that most people understand because it's been happening for probably 10 or 15 years at a real primary level. And when you look at the industries that have adopted that sort of an idea on a way to go to market or build partnerships, you're looking at things like sports and entertainment and fashion and some of these other industries that I think are the first ones to glom on to changing marketplaces like that, especially because I think it's not a far-fetched thing to tell them that they're really an audience business at the end of the day. The product and services they sell is less important as it is developing and monetizing the audience, whatever way makes sense. The example I'll use on the other side, I had a conversation with Mondelez, Oreo CEO, one time explaining that they were
not a cookie company, that they were an audience development monetization business. And the reality is that the entire organization is built around selling cookies. But the reality is really what you're doing is you're building Oreo fans, and you should be looking at those fans and trying to decide whatever provides value to them. Does that create an opportunity for you to leverage that into something that monetizes it? And if so, you should be putting those pilots into the marketplace. So a good example of that would be like a credit card collaboration between Chase and Oreo, right? There's a huge reason to do that and to try it. But when you first bring up ideas like that, there's nobody inside the organization thinking about things like that because they wouldn't consider themselves a finance company. So I think that kind of a industry, even CPG, which seems to be on the forefront of things, that's really new. And when you break that down to some of the industries we'll talk about in a minute, whether it's agriculture, infrastructure, supply chain, you're talking about industries that are even less brazen when it comes to embracing things that are happening in the marketplace. So there's a lot of exciting opportunities for them downstream when they think about their business that way.
Could following this line of thought ever lead a business to actually jettison what it previously considered to be its core business and just do everything else? Like, it's really hard to imagine, just for example, Oreo embraces the idea of being an audience development company, but then down the line, suddenly it stops even selling cookies and now it's just doing all this other stuff. I mean, Oreo is probably not the example of one that would do that, but is that a possible thing that can happen to businesses when they start embracing this mindset?
I don't know how much it would totally take over the business necessarily, but I think that it's definitely an opportunity to explore new ways to go to market. I think it's also, when you start going down that path, you start looking at your audience in a different light too. You stop thinking about them as people who are consumers of your product and people who are fans of the type of engagement that they have with you. A lot of this also comes from new people coming into our marketplace that grew up with the idea of a different idea about what ownership means, where they don't think about ownership as something that you literally build a moat around and own. They think about ownership in more of a fluid capacity, where a continued stream of offering value to an audience gives you the feeling of what ownership might feel like. It also allows you to think about ownership of anything, whether it's an audience or whatever, through the lens of collaboration with other partners. And so when you do that, the channels to develop your brand, to develop your audience, and to find new ways of monetization that really expand quite rapidly. And again, with all the new technology and things that we talked about that have come across now, even in the last 5 years, the road for anyone to be able to enter those marketplaces is really, really low. And so it's just an extremely opportunistic way to look at the marketplace, I think. Whether that comes back around and changes your fundamental business model or not, I'm not really sure. We did see instances of this over the years. Like, if you look at companies in retail sectors that started, you know, credit facilities, a lot of those credit facilities became larger than the retail operations themselves. And although, again, that's a kind of a trite example to look at what we're talking about, it came from a similar place. It came from a place of trying to understand what was necessary to deepen the audience and how could they build monetization opportunities around that. So I just think now you've got such a better toolbox available. Plus, again, you have this sort of behavioral shift in the mindset of just people, where the ideas about these core fundamental things like identity and ownership and all these things are a lot more fluid than they used to be. And so if you're open-minded and opportunistic, there's a lot of new opportunity in the marketplace to be had.
Speaking of new technologies, let's talk about some of the new technologies that you're going to be engaging with, surrounded by, and really a part of the conversation about at CES. So you're doing two things at CES, or at least you're going to be in two different places. One of them is going to be C-Space, which I'm very familiar with. That's my home at CES. I host interviews in the C-Space studio, and it makes a lot of sense to me why Vector would be there, because you're at the center of marketing and human connection. And you're also, though, hosting AI conversations at the new CES Foundry, which is the area that's going to be centering on AI, blockchain, quantum innovation. So let's start with the CES Foundry and what drew you to that.
When you think about C-Space and why C-Space exists, C-Space came about because of the technology age I talked about earlier, where the edge that everybody was looking for from a technology perspective just brought all the enterprise and marketers and all those folks to the table. And C-Space kind of evolved out of that. And so I think Foundry is kind of a response to what I'm talking about in the audience age. Of course, there's a technology piece to AI, and that's an important part and driving part. But I think the behavioral changes that are resulting because of that in the marketplace are even maybe even just as profound or more profound. And so we were drawn to Foundry this year, not just because it's the first year, but also because it's one of the few places, I think, where AI is not just being discussed, but it's being deployed. The conversations that are going to take place are going to be foundational in creating new types of go-to-market strategies across companies. You know, everybody's looking for a way to utilize the stuff we're talking about as an edge in business. And it's really a kind of a convergent point for leaders thinking about AI, not just as a tool, but as this new layer of infrastructure. And for us, that's where Vector really lives, is at this intersection of transformation strategy and execution. And so whether it's at C-Space or whether it's at Foundry, it's the same type of conversation, which is culture is changing the way that people go to market. And we want to be there for those kind of conversations. And I think CES Foundry just in general gives us a platform to bring a lot of those conversations forward, especially in sectors that are quietly being redefined by artificial intelligence, like infrastructure and supply chain and real world systems like agriculture. I mean, stuff that traditionally doesn't find itself to the forefront of the stage on innovation. These are actually the areas that are having the most disruptive innovation happening at a rapid pace right now. So it's exciting.
Well, let's talk about some of the AI breakthroughs that you might highlight in your sessions at CES and at the CES Foundry. Starting with agriculture, what's particularly exciting to you about AI there?
What's exciting about agriculture and some of the other areas we talked about is just these are high impact, high leverage spaces where AI's, you know, quietly starting to make a difference. And whether that's enabling better forecasting throughout the entire supply chain, whether it's making resources more sustainable or enabling faster decision cycles or just creating connection between each part of that process. Some of these processes, like in agriculture, from a grower all the way to a buyer, whether that's a consumer or a food buyer, there is a ton of steps that happen along the lines there where people are trying to make pretty critical real-time decisions about what their next step in the process is. There's a lot of partners in that space. And I think AI is enabling a lot of intelligence across layers of data that just hasn't been available to us before, at least not in the real-time version it is today. And you're also seeing a lot of change in the way that not just companies sort of act throughout that process, but there's a lot of changes in the way that companies are bringing forward new solutions to create new interaction points. And I think that becomes really interesting because if you think about even just between a grower and what exists on the buyer side, there was typically kind of one agronomist that sort of worked through the process to connect those two functions. And now you have multiple layers of infrastructure and software and data, and the ag tech business has exploded in the last 5 to 10 years. And so there's a lot of new development going on in that space. And then if you throw AI on top of it, it's sort of like fuel on top of a fire. It's creating faster, more adaptive cycles in that growth process. And so, again, for us, these interaction models we're talking about are probably the most interesting thing and exciting thing that we see happening there and why we're so interested in it. Because from a Vector perspective, when you have things like that happening inside of an industry, it obviously creates all kinds of new ways to create sustainable commercial models and partnerships and ecosystems. And people are making money in new ways that they didn't think they could do before. And to me, also having an engineering background, these aren't just flashy use cases that you see. They're actually foundational shifts that are happening. And when those are demonstrable and on stage in front of people, that's what makes those things so valuable.
Can you give us an example, maybe it's hypothetical, maybe it's near term possible, of how an agriculture company or ag-related company could use AI and also move into this more audience-focused mentality and maybe have new ways of doing business that were not possible or were not thought of before?
If you go back to the source, I guess, to the farmer or the grower, the easiest way to understand just even like small impact of AI is that you have these growers and farmers in fields for generations producing the source product of what ultimately all of us buy down the line in some way, shape, or form. And those folks are passing knowledge about the way to increase yield or lots of other different attributes like that, different measurements of success, they're passing those things along generation to generation. The younger generations are becoming more interested in being data-driven about the way that they're making decisions. You've got multiple farms in the same area, right? So there's similar things happening around them. And the lack of connectivity in all of that just creates this chasm of kind of intelligence, if you just want to call it that generally. The second thing is that each of these folks have their own unique sense of what to do or why to do it, right? They have their own taste or whatever you want to call it on how they do their thing. And so even if you just dropped an AI agent into place that allows them to talk to somebody every single day who almost becomes like a second hand to them about what's happening on their farm, taking in the data that they know about that farmer and that farm and the way that they like to do things, plus the intelligence that's coming from third-party sources, that single use case could be extremely valuable in changing the way that we source food in general, and not just creating higher yields and other things. So there's probably 100 different examples along the line of where AI is creating these new ways of working. But what's cool about it to me is that it's not just the tech, right? Because we've been talking about tech like this for a long time. The investment in AI at a macro level makes it easier because things are faster now, and it's behavioral wise, it works better. But people are adopting this behavior at such a rapid rate that the barrier to entry is really low for these things. And so what you're seeing is just probably a lot of solutions coming forward that have been talked about just haven't been technically possible. And that's what's really fascinating.
What I think is funny is that a cursory glance at Vector, it seems like this cool cutting edge marketing AI company. And you're talking about these industries that maybe to some people don't seem cutting edge. I think if you're in them, if you're in agriculture, if you're in infrastructure, you understand how much AI is and could potentially revolutionize things. But is it almost like more exciting to find how AI can transform these quote unexciting areas, because those are maybe the areas of biggest opportunity that people would miss, as opposed to like creating a more realistic cat video with Gen AI?
Yes is the short answer to that. I think there's probably some perspective from my part behind that, but I've been was an engineer turned marketer, I guess, through back when everybody was creating microsites back in the day and digital was 5% of spend. That's where I started. And a lot of us who started in that space are now running the majority of the agency world or sitting on brand side now that digital is the primary driver. And the reality is, I think that the agency business, let's say the helping brands, helping customers, helping businesses side of the world, or the service business, it's just sort of like over the last 10 years, probably, it's just became more and more about pumping out content faster and cheaper and more efficiently. And so the value add side of things has just shifted immensely. I remember 15, 20 years ago, when we were in meetings talking about digital, we were talking about how digital could help these businesses grow or expand, or a lot of the things that Vector's talking about now. And for some reason, that just kind of turned into this commoditized view of how can we use this stuff to bill hours and deliver assets. To some extent, the creative is being driven by that as well. And so we just lost that. And I think post-pandemic, what I saw was that a lot of our customers, these big enterprise customers, they were starting to realize they weren't really getting a lot of value from the agency relationships they had. And so some of the mass buying stuff, like buying a lot of media or being able to, if you do generate a ton of content, being able to go to a partner and generate that cheaper, those things are always going to be there. But the ability to sort of swim upstream into higher margin, higher value opportunities with clients to help them grow their business, you just didn't see anybody focusing on that. And part of the reasons we started Vector was because we were even unable to sell that at the agency side of the world, even though to me it seems pretty evident that's a huge shift that's happening. I think what is kind of marketing mean and those kind of things going into the future, I really think that to me, marketing has always been a core function of growth, just like sales or strategy or any of those kind of things. And I think with Vector, I hope we're finding ourselves back into that conversation. I can tell you, if you talk to our clients and ask them how we're helping their business, they would talk about the revenue and the new ways that we are helping that business fiscally grow, not how we're helping streamline and save money. I think being efficient is like table stakes. And maybe that's just my engineering brain working, but you're always supposed to do stuff the most efficient as possible. So the hard stuff is going into an industry and finding new ways to grow your business. And the bigger the business is, I actually think it's even harder because they're fighting almost the inertia that's driving them away from those types of things because so much has been built around trying to take the primary asset and grow it.
Yeah, it sounds like we may have had just now a bit of a preview of the session that you're doing at C-Space on the Chunju role of market. Is that some of that stuff? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I look forward to hearing more from you there.
CMOs are being asked to step up and become growth architects. They're not just brand stewards. And when you talk to some of the CMOs that we all revere in the space right now, none of them are going to disagree with that. And I think that means that their responsibility is to shape ecosystems and try to identify new monetization models. They're sort of co-owning outcomes with the rest of the C-suite. And I think some companies in the space are still operating as if marketing's role ends at awareness and conversion. And I just don't think that's enough anymore. Marketing needs to be more embedded in how the business works, not just how it looks.
So you are an agency that is evolving and looking to the future. And now we talk about AI having agency. We're talking about AI agents increasingly. So I want to get your take on what it means when AI agents are out there in the world taking actions, not just answering questions. How does that change the relationship between businesses and their audiences?
I think it's going to flip everything on its head a bit. I don't know when that shift is going to happen. We're talking about agentic right now, like it's functioning 100% in the wild. It's really not. But when we get to that point, it certainly will flip anything. When agents can act on your behalf, that experience layer that we've spent so much time talking about for the last 20 years really becomes automated, which means that you're shifting trust, timing, and things like that to the agent. And context becomes kind of the new battleground. I think brands are going to have to re-earn attention, you know, through providing value and utility, not just as creative, but they'll have to start designing for agents as well as people. I think that's kind of the base level stakes. The bigger part is that you'll have less access to people as influencers. So if you think about it today, most of the decisions you make, whether you do or don't participate in something, buying a product, not buying a product or anything else, a lot of that is influence is pretty visual. So people can see it. That means brands can see it. And so they can adapt and change. When a lot of the influence is happening behind the scenes and people can't see it, you have less of an opportunity to tailor the things that you're bringing to market to that person. And I think you're
like when the main thing I'm being influenced by is a one-on-one chatbot conversation as opposed to a widely distributed commercial or something like that. And it's just this one, it's this highly personalized thing that I'm being influenced by.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think even just like right now, what's happening in a business, a huge pillar of kind of what we're doing is this idea that super senior people stood up with a back office. That's, I use an agentic word really, really loosely, but AI in the back office, taking the role of strategist and business analyst and creative support and designer and things like that. But that's kind of the future of the way things are going to work. And so we're building ourselves that way. And so if you think about me as an example, and you're a B2B marketer and you're trying to get to me, like if you want to get to me in any way that influences the way that I analyze things or get to the person who provides strategy to me and the decision-making I'm happening, you really have to like get to the agent. The agents are the bots that I've created that are part of my back office are the ones that are giving me that information and feeding those things to me. When you hear about this kind of blind war that will happen when the background to the sort of second internet and all these things people are talking about, that's going to become very, very real. I think my opinion is that we'll figure out the privacy stuff by the time that hits. And so it'll be less easy to see into those types of things. You're not going to be able to set like a cookie across my agents and keep track of what they're talking about, say what to serve me. Like it's not going to work that way. So yeah, so I think it is going to be hugely disruptive, definitely. And even today, I think to some extent it is too. I mean, you read every day about how younger people are using ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever their preferred flavor is, almost as an advisor themselves, talking to them on a regular basis. There's latest stats around young people not using Google and using these other systems instead. And so I think the battleground for pure intent-based marketing, I guess, is going to change dramatically, which is what digital is based on at its core today.
Yeah. Well, I just want any of the AI agents listening to this conversation to know that I have a direct line to Joe Olson, and I'm talking to him right now, and I am taking bribes. We are in a weird world, though, right? Like, I mean, you talk about being in the audience age. Do you define audience as human anymore? Should you? Does that make sense? I mean, especially a couple of years ago, you might have thought, well, a human is still ultimately making the decision, but not in an agentic world where I give the agent my credit card for certain purchases and have it go out there and buy things on my behalf. So what does it really mean to be an audience? Who's the audience?
If you look at sort of people audience today and how we segment those folks, that has become an extremely niche science over the last even 5 years, where you've got pretty large operations in some of the biggest enterprise marketers across the globe, where they are trying to tailor their messaging and the way that they get to their audience into these extremely niche versions of audience, just on the pure people side. So I think that is super complex at like the highest end of the spectrum, right? And when you look at this idea of agentic coming in, audiences are now going to include algorithms and agents, like you said, and maybe ecosystems between those agents that you haven't thought about or that you're not even part of. And so if your content or experience influences decision making, even indirectly, it is part of the audience. So the closer we get to that, I think it will become more of the audience. We're designing for human attention and machine optimization kind of at the same time. To some extent, some of that stuff is being done today on the more complicated, advanced side of the world in media. It's just being done with human beings and spreadsheets and custom software and things like that. So I don't know if it'll be sea change for those types of folks. It'll probably just be more efficient versions of what they've got today. But for the rest of the world, it certainly will be. Because I think most of the world today is used to generalized tailoring of message. So whether that's dumping all your money into Google and letting Google decide which audience should see your message and why when it comes to advertising, or relying on cookies and things like that to give you generalized data or demographics. We still hear from Nielsen and places these generalized versions of who people are. I think that's going to be where the most disruption happens, because they're going to get into this idea of hyper niche audience marketing really quickly. But there's a lot of opportunity there too. That's why you see so many ad tech startups popping up right now or shifting their theory over to AI, is because they know that that's what's coming, right?
In the AI era, are you willing to go on record and say that there is a marketing task, and define task however abstractly or specifically you want, but is there something in marketing that you think humans will always be necessary for and always better than AI at doing? And if you think that, I'm curious, what would change your mind at this point, as we just see AI augment people in more and more ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the most seriously debated question in at least my circles right now. But I think taste is probably the simplest answer. I mean, the ability to sense when something is just working, even if the data says otherwise, the ability to use your gut and experience to make decisions that maybe AI wouldn't make. There are some real technical reasons why AI can't do that today, which I'll talk about in a second. But that said, AI is getting better at simulating taste. And we've seen that come out in lots of different ways, whether it's Midjourney and other image programs generating images that use the same type of aesthetic as the audience asks for more of it. Things like that, where they're taking trends and using them as taste. But the real value might be in the human who knows when to listen to AI and when to override it. So I think, to me, that's where seniority, for lack of a better description, or experience comes into place. When we were hiring or building our model for Vector, we kind of had 5 criteria for different folks that we wanted to bring in as partners. And one of those was that you've been in 1,000 rooms. And I think being in 1,000 rooms, just as a metaphor, means that you've been there and you've seen this stuff a lot of times. So you brought a lot of just data sampling in yourself, which AI can do. But the problem is that AI learns from places like the internet, and it's now starting to learn from third-party data and things, but it doesn't capture all the steps in your brain as a human being that you go through to make those decisions. So I think simulation of taste, simulation of experience is probably the best we can get right now. Whether that will change in the future, I don't know. I mean, that's the reason these large companies like Meta and Google and OpenAI are paying unbelievable amounts of money to people to come in to try to help solve that fundamental challenge. I don't know if it'll ever get replaced. Maybe it'll get simulated to the point where 90% of the time it's pretty close. But when you really look at what human beings do, 90% of the decisions they're making aren't captured in data that AI can consume. And the second thing is that a lot of it is just taste. They're pulling things kind of out of the air and going, this is right or this is wrong. Some of the best tastemakers in our lifetimes, I don't think you're going to be able to replicate them with AI.
All right, team human, that's a relief. I want to wrap up here by looking at CES itself. If we're in the audience age and we're talking about all this with audience and AI and evolution of everything, so what does that mean for a giant global gathering at the cutting edge of technology like CES itself?
I think CES is becoming less about launching products and it's becoming more about launching platforms and partnerships and new business models. And the Foundry is just a new way to organize people that might be thinking about those three things in similar ways, just like C-Space. But that's what really CES is about now. It's no longer just a technology show. It's really about a reflection of kind of this broader shift that companies that show up at CES today aren't just selling tech. They're selling future states of what the world might look like. And so if you're at CES and you're looking at it through that lens, all you're seeing is convergence opportunities. And at those convergence opportunities, you're going to be able to understand whether you or, in our case, one of our customers is in a place to take advantage of that for the growth of what they're trying to do. And so to me, that's really what CES has become. Where again, if you go back 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, probably, it wasn't really like that. It was really a place where there was just new cool products or the next version of whatever TV you're going to buy in 18 months, right? So all those things are incredibly important, by the way. But I think the reality is that it draws an audience now that is trying to make these connections to try to see what the future state of their industry or other industries are going to look like in order to be prepared or to get out in front of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for giving us a little glimpse of that future here today. Joe Olson, co-founder, partner, and CEO of Vector. Thank you so much for joining us here on CES Tech Talk, and we can't wait to see you at CES 2026.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, James.
Well, thank you, and that's our show for now, but there's always more tech to talk about. So subscribe, follow, like, share, whatever it takes to keep our AI overlords happy. You can get even more CES and prepare for Vegas at ces.tech. That's ces.tech. Our show is produced by Nicole Vidovich with help from Paige Morris and Doug Weinbaum, edited by Third Spoon. I'm James Kotecki, talking tech on CES Tech Talk.